Go ahead and open up your Bibles to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. We have the privilege of gathering together every Sunday. And in our culture, Sunday is typically a day of rest for most people, especially those inside the church. You go back to why this is so. The book of Acts describes the disciples getting together on Sunday, the first day of the week. But the idea, the pattern of resting every 7 days goes much further back than the book of Acts in the New Testament. It goes much further back than the late history of Israel in the Old Testament. It goes all the way back to the beginning, to the creation account as God created the earth and the sky and all the universe in 7 days. In order to prepare us for the message this morning in Luke chapter 6, in Jesus' interactions with the Pharisees, his healing of a man, his teaching to the people who were sincere in their following, I want to take a chronological look at the Sabbath. At the Sabbath. In the Old Testament, we find it first in Genesis chapter 2. The word itself simply means a cessation of work. To stop exerting oneself, to rest or to repose. And it originated with God on that seventh day of creation, where he communicates that after working for 6 days and making the heavens and the earth, he rests on the seventh day. Now, this is not because God needed to rest. He wasn't tired out because of exerting himself and making everything. He simply stopped working. His power is indefinite. His ability to exert energy is inexhaustible. So he simply stops working on the seventh day and ceases from that exertion. And what he does there is he gives a pattern for all of creation to follow after himself. God rested from all his work which he had done on the seventh day. He blesses the seventh day, we're told in Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3. And then he sanctifies the seventh day. He sets it apart. He says, this day is different. It's unique. I want you to live differently on the seventh day as compared to the first 6 days of a typical week. This pattern was followed by all followers of God as we look at the New Testament or the Old Testament. Unmistakably, it was observed by the nation of Israel. We see that at the beginning in Exodus chapter 16, and we just began to look at this last Friday in our weekly Bible study, and we'll look more in depth at this in this coming Friday. But Exodus 16 is where God provides manna for the nation of Israel as they're wandering around in the wilderness. And he gives them a pattern to follow by saying, I want you to collect this manna for 6 days, but on that sixth day, I'm going to give you twice as much. And on the seventh day, I don't want you to collect any because I want you to rest on that seventh day, to cease from the labor of going out and gathering up the manna from the ground. Israel follows that for the most part. And this is even before the giving of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments happen a few chapters later. And what happens there is in the fourth commandment, God says, in this Decalogue, this standard way of pleasing him, number four, I want you to keep the Sabbath. Mixed in there with not killing people, not committing adultery, not cheating, not lying, I want you to keep the Sabbath. Some ways that Israel was told they were to rest on that seventh day. Exodus chapter 35 says they are not to kindle a fire on that day of rest. Numbers chapter 15 says they are not to gather any wood outside to bring in to kindle a fire on that day of rest. Jeremiah 17 tells us they were not to bear any heavy burdens. There was no extensive travel or trading on the day. All work was forbidden. Except acts of mercy, acts of necessity, and acts of worship. Now, keep that in your mind as we move forward and get to the time where Jesus interacts with the Pharisees over the Sabbath in a little bit. The purpose of the Sabbath, as told to us in Exodus 23, was rest and refreshment, not just for the people, but for their animals and everybody who's associated with them. Breaking the rules of the Sabbath brought about what? This shows how serious God was. It brought about death. You weren't just put on restriction. It wasn't just you're in a timeout for a little while. You were killed. This was something God communicates in Exodus 31, Numbers chapter 15. If you broke the Sabbath because of ignorance or you made a mistake, you were shown mercy. But God was serious about a day of rest every 7 days for the people of Israel. Leviticus 26:2, God says, "You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary." Why? Because I am the Lord. A close connection there between who God is and his followers. Now, to do this, your heart had to be in it. You couldn't just go through the motions. Isaiah chapter 1, Amos chapter 8, speak to the people of Israel saying, you know, you're outwardly observing what I'm asking you to do, but your hearts are just sitting there on that seventh day saying, I can't wait to get up tomorrow and go to work. I can't wait to get back to what I want to do on that first day of the week. God says, no, I want you to have an attitude of rest and to immerse yourself in the day and use it for its purposes. Keeping the Sabbath, as God communicated, along with the entire other 612 laws of the Old Testament. Doing all of that, it served as a sign for the people of Israel. It served as a sign, first, to the surrounding nations. Everybody who looked at them saw that they were different. Nehemiah actually has to close the city gates to prevent foreigners from coming in and selling their goods on that seventh day of rest. The people who lived around Israel, they didn't practice resting once a week. They just worked 7 days a week and just did what they wanted to do. And so God doing this, this is yet another way that it would be a sign to everybody around. It also was a sign to the people of Israel themselves, reminding them of their special relationship with God, Ezekiel chapter 20. This would humble people. Sometimes you wake up on the seventh day and you don't want to rest, Israel would think. They want to keep working, they want to keep doing. But this would humble them, it would cause them to stop and to reflect. It also would cause them to realize they were completely dependent upon God to provide. It wasn't their own power doing anything. And by stopping work and seeing that, no, God continued to provide for us even though we didn't do anything that entire day, it showed them that he was the one in control, not themselves. This was, for Israel, a God-ordained cadence to life. Now you move through the Old Testament into the New Testament period. Remember, there are 400 silent years between the end of the Old Testament, Malachi, and the beginning of the New Testament, Matthew. What happened during those centuries is that the Jewish leaders, they greatly added to the details of how to carry this out, how to be obedient to resting on the Sabbath. Now, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that their motives were very good. Let's say that they sought to help people, initially speaking at least, that if the rule was here, they wanted to protect that from never being broken by anybody and to encourage people to obey that rule, they built safeguards around it. But by building those safeguards, it was like barnacles on a ship, a ship's hull on the bottom. They kept adding and adding and adding and adding, so you understand that if you don't clean the barnacles off the bottom of a ship, you can't even see the hull eventually. It becomes encrusted. And that's what happened to this law of the Sabbath. It became encrusted with all these details. As time passed, the heart was left out of obeying God's direction. It became more outwardly focused. All that was left was a list of rules. And they taught, just do these things, and don't do these things, and you won't break God's law. Don't worry about the heart behind it. Just do these and don't do these, and you'll be safe. The Jewish leaders that are described as Pharisees in the New Testament, they came up over time with 39 different clarifications of work that was forbidden. These were the apparent experts in the law, and so the people listened to them. They were the ones who studied it in depth, and people followed what they said. Here are some examples of the rules they came up with. It was forbidden by the people to walk more than 2,000 steps. And yes, they would count the steps on a typical Sabbath day. 2,000 steps is about a half a mile, and there came a phrase, Sabbath day journey. And that was understood by the entire nation. A Sabbath day journey from this point to this point, they knew exactly how far that was. 2,000 steps or less. It was forbidden for a scribe to carry his pen in his belt on the Sabbath. That's too close to work. It's too tempting. So let's just make this rule. And if you don't carry the pen, you won't be tempted to write with the pen on the day of rest. It was forbidden to plug a hole in a cask with wax to keep the liquid from pouring out. Yes, this was written down, and it was understood, and it was followed. It was forbidden to wipe a wound. It was forbidden, and these get crazy because they are crazy. It was forbidden for a man with a peg leg to walk at all on the Sabbath, because if his artificial leg were to poke a hole in the ground and the wind came and blew some seed in that hole, then the man would be guilty of plowing and planting, therefore working on the Sabbath. You see how careful they were? And again, take their motives as good at the very beginning. They're just wanting to protect this poor guy with a peg leg, and they don't want him to fall into the trap of breaking the Sabbath, so let's just keep him at home. The hard-heartedness of these laws are seen in their creativity. Alfred Edersheim, in his book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, says this regarding those rules. If a man wished to move a sheaf on his field, the sheaf is a bundle of grain on his field, on the Sabbath, which of course would be labor, all he had to do was to lay a spoon on top of that sheaf. Then, in order to move the spoon from one place to another place, he could pick up the whole sheaf and move it from one place to another place. And that wouldn't be work, because all he was doing was moving the spoon, which wasn't against the rules of breaking the Sabbath. What's happening here? Well, there's adding and there's substituting of human rules for divine law. Jesus accused the Pharisees in Matthew 15:9 of teaching as doctrine the precepts of men. And this is exactly what's happening here regarding the Sabbath. They were reducing obedience to God to only outward observance. And with all these rules, they were making it a burden to follow after God. When we get to the Gospels, the Sabbath was the day to wear your best clothes, the day to go to synagogue, the day to eat the best meal of the week. And understand that Jesus himself kept the Sabbath. We see that in Luke chapter 4, verse 16. Now, with all that information, all that is background, we come to Luke chapter 6. And we look here in verses 1 through 11 at the Lord of the Sabbath. We're going to encounter here familiar characters. Jesus, of course. We're going to see his disciples. And we're going to see the Pharisees. And as often happens, there is conflict. Past several accounts have shown us that Jesus has authority. Here we're going to see that he has authority over the Sabbath. And this issue here is an issue that was right out in front of the people, because it came week after week after week after week. It wouldn't be every day that he healed somebody of a disease. It wouldn't be every day that he pronounced somebody cleansed from all their sin. But the Sabbath just continually came. And Jesus knew that, and he taught much on it. This was the one element of the law most offered by the Pharisees. If Jesus can prove himself Lord of the Sabbath, he can prove himself Lord of the entire Old Testament law. And we'll see that he indeed is the master of our rest. And if he's the master of our rest, he's the master of the rest of our life. Look first at verses 1 through 5, and you can follow along in your bulletins if it's helpful to you. An outline, eating in the grain fields on the Sabbath. And first, there's a harmless activity there in verse 1. Luke writes for us, "Now it happened that he was passing through some grain fields on a Sabbath, and his disciples were picking the heads of grain, rubbing them in their hands, and eating the grain." Luke tells us that this event is on a Sabbath. We're not told why they were traveling through this grain field or what the purpose was moving from one direction to another direction, but that's not the issue. The issue is when this happens, and it happens on a Sabbath. And that's going to be the important element here. The disciples are walking and they're eating grain. They're probably hungry, and there's grain right there, and they're eating. Now, for you and me, we look at this and we think, well, that doesn't seem very good. They don't own this grain field. Who are they to eat somebody else's grain? It doesn't fit into our culture. But in that culture, it was fine. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 23, the details of how you treat your neighbor's grain and your neighbor's produce is described with these words. This is verses 24 and 25 in Deuteronomy chapter 23. When you eat or you enter into your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes until you are fully satisfied. Well, that's different. We would call that trespassing first and then stealing second. But they were allowed to do that because they were a nation that shared everything. They followed after God together. And you were allowed to enter into your neighbor's vineyard and eat as much as you wanted until you're full. God goes on and describes some more detail and says this, but you shall not put any in your basket. So you can't go to your neighbor's vineyard and collect some and bring it home. But you can just eat there on the go, as it were. When you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. So picking is fine, harvesting is not. And so the issue here regarding what the disciples are doing, they're not guilty of pillaging someone's field. We might get that in verse 1 and say, okay, the Pharisees are going to attack them for stealing stuff. But that's not what happens. The Pharisees understood that this is okay to do in and of itself. Jesus and his disciples understood it's okay to do this in and of itself. The issue is when it's happening. It's on a Sabbath. The critical question, verse 2. And this critical question is not critical in that it's important. It's critical in that it's judgmental. But some Pharisees said, why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? These Pharisees, remember there are only about 6,000 of them in Israel at the time, they're just everywhere. Every time there's something good happening, they're there watching. They're like the thought police chasing after Jesus and his disciples trying to pinpoint something they're doing wrong. And that's exactly their motive as the Gospels move forward. You see the question they ask, why do you do what is not lawful? The you there is plural. They're addressing the disciples, not Jesus. The disciples, because they were the ones eating. Sunday through Friday, this would be okay. But this is Saturday. It's a Sabbath. And it's not lawful. According to whom? Well, according to them. They've made specific rules for the entire nation to follow. And this does not fit into those rules. According to rabbinic laws, there are at least two rules broken here, at least two sins that the Pharisees see the disciples committing. First, they're plucking the heads of grain. That was not allowed on the Sabbath. That was viewed as reaping and harvesting. Reaping and harvesting. Now, it's a small scale, we understand. But essentially, when you reap, you're getting the heads of grain off of the grain. And so that's what they're doing on a small scale. Second sin, they're rubbing them in their hands. Well, they're guilty there of sifting and grinding and threshing and winnowing. They're preparing food, and that is not allowed. The Talmud, which is Jewish oral tradition, a commentary on the Old Testament laws, says this, in case a woman rolls wheat to remove the husks, it is considered as sifting. If she rubs the heads of the wheat, it is regarded as threshing. If she cleans off what is stuck to the sides, it is sifting out fruit. If she bruises the ears, it is grinding. If she throws them up in her hand, it is winnowing. They had thought of everything because they wanted to make sure nobody broke this law. Jesus, in response to this critical question, gives a clarifying illustration in verses 3 and 4. Look what it says there. And Jesus answering them said, now you notice, Jesus answers. Again, the Pharisees talk to the disciples, and Jesus enters in and intervenes. So Jesus answers and says to them, have you not even read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and took and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for any to eat except the priest alone, and gave it to his companions. Now, I want you to turn with me back to 1 Samuel chapter 21, because this is the story that Jesus is referring to. 1 Samuel 21. Here, what David is doing is he is fleeing for his own life from Saul. And as he is fleeing and he's out there, he and his men become hungry. Let's just look at verses 3 through 6. He comes, 1 Samuel 21, verse 3, and he says to the priest there, "Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found." The priest answered David and said, "There is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women." David answered the priest and said to him, "Surely women have been kept from us as previously when I sent out, and the vessels of the young men were holy. Though it was an ordinary journey, how much more today will their vessels be holy?" So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. So let's describe what's happening here. Going back to Luke chapter 6 now, Jesus summarizes that account by saying, when David was hungry and his men were with him in verse 3, he goes into the house of God and he eats the consecrated bread. The loaves which David ate, these were part of what was set forth in the tabernacle or the temple before the Lord. The Jews called these loaves the loaves of the face, or the presence of God, the loaves before the presence of God, showbread. And it was prepared on a Friday. It was made of the finest wheat flour that had been sifted 11 times. There were 12 loaves according to the number of the tribes of Israel. And they were arranged in 2 piles or rows of 6 each. Each loaf was made out of approximately 5 pints of wheat. Replacing the old loaves with the new loaves was the first priority of the functioning priest on the beginning of the Sabbath, Saturday when it began. The old bread was placed on a table in the porch of the sanctuary and distributed among the outgoing priest and the incoming priest. They rotated weekly as far as the duties that needed to be happening in the temple. It was eaten during the Sabbath and in the temple itself. Only one tribe was able to eat this bread. And only certain members of this tribe were able to eat this bread. These were the Levites, the priests, and only the serving priest could eat this bread. It was the bread of the presence. It was special. It was consecrated or holy. The rules concerning this bread are just as important in Jesus' story as the rules regarding the Sabbath. Let's see if we can put this together. We want to be able to do this because this is Jesus' argument to the Pharisees. He's not just telling a story. David was in need. He and his men were on the run, and they were famished. The disciples were in need. They were walking through the grain fields, and they were hungry. Mark, in his description of what's going on here, says that Jesus also said, "Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath." David was a man after God's own heart, we're told in the Old Testament. So because in this circumstance we can trust his motives were pure and not just some outward thing, as he came to the priest there, him being a follower of God with a heart that was genuine, he could ask for the bread knowing that it was for the priest. But he was in a situation where he needed it. And he knew that God put compassion above rule, mercy above the letter of the law. And so he could ask for it with a clear conscience. The priest could give it to him with a clear conscience. Here in the account in Luke, you have the disciples with Jesus, the high priest. He's walking through the grain fields with them, and they're eating from the grain. Jesus, as the priest, understands that there are rules that you can't do on the Sabbath. But those were priestly rules. as far as the Pharisees giving them those rules and saying, you can't do this, you can't do this. Now, as you think about what Jesus is saying, you might wonder about those times in the Bible when it seems to be just the opposite. When it seems like there are rules that are broken and the punishment is severe. Think about Leviticus chapter 10, Aaron's two sons. They decide, instead of following the recipe that God gave them for making the incense to present before him, that they would make their own recipe. They would change the measurements. We're not told exactly what they changed. Maybe they added some other ingredients or took some ingredients out. They presented that before God, and what happens? Fire comes out and consumes them, and they're burnt up immediately. Well, that's serious. That's a consequence. You think about Saul. You remember when he was there and the Philistines were in the distance, and he's waiting for Samuel to come, and Samuel was a priest, so Samuel could perform the sacrifice? Samuel doesn't come. He's delayed day after day after day. And so Saul finally says, well, I'm just going to do the sacrifice myself. One problem. He's not a priest. He couldn't do that according to God's rules. Samuel comes, finds out that he sacrificed, and the consequence, it's severe. The kingdom is ripped out of his hands. How do we put these together with what Jesus is saying? The difference is the heart of the people who are seeking God's mercy and flexibility in time of need. Nadab and Abihu were just messing around with the ingredients. There was no heart there. There was no need there for them to change what was going on. Saul, we understand as his story continues, his heart was never following after God. He was never really in it for God's sake. He was in it for his own sake. But you look at what happened with David. You look at what happened with the disciples here in Luke 6. There is genuine heart. Here's the principle. This is true for the Sabbath and all the Old Testament law. When moral obligation clashes with ceremonial law, moral issues always win out. Put more simply, morality trumps ceremony. If there's a right or wrong issue, if there's a need to help somebody, if there's compassion that's called for, that's going to win out over what's written on a piece of paper that we have to do this or we can't do that. That's the way God is. That's the way he's always been, and that's the way he intended the law to be followed. There's a God-ordained overriding the letter of the law when human need called for it. Now, those who know God, like David, they knew this. Those who don't know God, like the Pharisees, they had no idea what Jesus was talking about. They would just say, yeah, but the letter of the law says this. And they couldn't get past what the compassion, the mercy, the idea that the Sabbath was made for man. It wasn't the other way around. They didn't understand. Look now at the forceful declaration in verse 5. And he was saying to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Here's the summary. Here's the great power of Jesus. The Son of Man is a title he loved to use for himself. It communicates authority, representative of all human beings. In the Old Testament, it's applied to Ezekiel and to Daniel. And he says, the Son of Man, talking about himself, he's saying, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. The word Lord there is kurios, also means master. And what's happening here is Jesus is claiming authority. He's claiming authority that only God has. He has shown himself just in the first five chapters and a few verses of Luke that he has authority over temptation. He can conquer it. He has authority over disease and illness. He can defeat that. He has authority over evil spirits. He can cast them out. He has authority over men's lives. He can point to them and say, you follow me, and they do it. He has authority over the forgiveness of sin. He can declare that a man is forgiven. Jesus is saying here that, in his words, I am master of the Sabbath. I own it. I am the one who made it. It's not yours, Pharisees. It doesn't belong to you. In fact, look at what you've done to it. I, the God-man, made it. I know why I made it, and I understood how it should be used. In the New Testament, we're told that Jesus is Lord of not just the Sabbath, but he's Lord of the harvest. In Luke 10:2, Revelation 11, verse 4, he's Lord of the earth. Jesus owns the earth. Jesus owns the harvest. Jesus owns the church. Jesus owns the Sabbath. He's in charge, past, present, and future. He's the Lord of all. Now, as we think through just these first five verses, we understand Jesus is saying, I am Lord. And each of these little vignettes in the biographies of Jesus in the Gospels are just showing you what he's Lord over. And here we have him being portrayed as Lord of the Sabbath. And we understand that we call Jesus Lord, and that means he's Lord of our lives as well. Saint Augustine said, Jesus Christ is not valued at all until he is valued above all. He is indeed the Lord. So the declaration is made. Anybody can say, I'm in charge of this, I'm master of this, but now it's time for Jesus to prove it. Look now at the healing in the synagogue on the Sabbath, beginning in verse 6. First, there's a healing opportunity. On another Sabbath, this is verse 6 again, Luke writes, he, Jesus, entered the synagogue and was teaching, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. Don't overlook the idea that Jesus is teaching here. This continued to be a mainstay of his ministry. He was continually teaching the people more about God and how to follow him. The man here is described as having a withered hand. This is either the result of a disease or an accident, or perhaps it's been like that way since birth. There's an opportunity here. It's perfect. There's the Sabbath, and there's the need of mercy. Somebody needs help. A critical audience. The Pharisees play their role pretty much the same way every single time. Verse 7. The scribes and the Pharisees were watching him closely to see if he healed on the Sabbath so that they might find reason to accuse him. They were watching him. The Greek tense gives us the idea that they kept on watching him. They had their eyes on him. Now, as Jesus is teaching, there's no PowerPoint going on behind him. There's nothing to look at. But they're not listening to what he's saying. They're just watching him. They want to see what he does. And Luke says specifically, they wanted to see if he healed on the Sabbath. The Greek word for heal is therapeuo, from which we get the word therapeutic. Now, the law of the Pharisees did allow for medical help on the Sabbath, but only when the life was in danger. Now, you could give birth on the Sabbath, that was okay, and so we're thankful for that, I guess, as you look back. You could also circumcise your son on the Sabbath if the days lined up when it was supposed to be done. They didn't want to break one law to obey another law. But other than that, you couldn't help somebody on the Sabbath in a medical way. And the Pharisees are there, and the end of the verse is very clear, so that, here's the reason, here's the purpose that they're there. They're not listening. They're watching him so that they might find reason to accuse him. The Pharisees themselves were watching Jesus. At other times in the Gospels, they are said to send spies out to gather evidence against him, scoop up some dirt. They want to get more and more reason to destroy Jesus. Jesus knows this is going on. He sees the man. He knows the Pharisees. And so let's look at our merciful Lord, beginning in verse 8. But he, this is Jesus, knew what they were thinking. Sheer power. Omniscience at work here. Only God does this. He knew what they were thinking. He knew their thoughts. We've said this before. This is often the case in the Greek behind the words in the Gospels. But this is the Greek word dialogismos. You can hear the word dialogue. They're reasoning in their minds. They're thinking in their minds. They're trying to put together some questions that they can accuse Jesus with. Let me ask you, would it have been easy for Jesus just to wait until the next day? Make an appointment with the guy? Say, come back tomorrow. I'll work with you. You've had a long time with this withered hand. Just wait a few more hours. We'll take care of it tomorrow. He could have easily done that, but he doesn't. He doesn't. He wants to teach. He's not willing not to cause a stir. There's only one right thing to do. As God, he understands the connection between the law and mercy. Middle of verse 8. He says to the man with the withered hand, get up and come forward. And he got up and came forward. Imagine the excitement of the crowd now. This is going to be a great, memorable day in church. Remember, or think about the excitement of the man. Jesus is talking to me. He's heard the stories about healing, and he's wondering if this withered hand can be taken care of on this day. Verse 9, and Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to destroy it? What Jesus does here is bring out into the open the thoughts of the Pharisees. He brings the entire issue out into the open. When he asks the question, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? To do good would be to heal the man. When he asks about doing harm or to destroy life, that would be doing nothing. Doing nothing for this man who's in need in the present is tantamount to doing evil, to doing wickedness against him. This is especially so when you have the ability to help. Mark tells us the Pharisees didn't say anything to this. They just remained silent and kept watching. Look at verse 10. After looking around at them all, he said to him, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored. So Jesus looks around at them all. Again, Mark tells us that there's anger in Jesus' heart, because he sees the lack of compassion in these Pharisees. He understands what's going on in them. He can teach until he's blue in the face. He can bring somebody up who's in obvious need, and they still are not willing to part with their own man-made rules. Compassionless. So he's angry. The Pharisees' hardness of heart is revealed. Jesus says, stretch out your hand, and he's healed. Finally, verse 11, a foolish reaction here. But they themselves were filled with rage. These are the Pharisees, and they discussed together what they might do to Jesus. In contrast to what would be the natural response here, to be just in awe of what just happened. There was just a man whose hand didn't work, and it was withered, and now it does work. They just go right over that, and they're filled with anger. They're filled with rage. This Greek word's only used one other time over in 2 Timothy chapter 3, and there it's translated folly. This rage that the Pharisees have is akin to insanity. It's just foolishness. There's a senseless anger going on here. They are at their wits' end with Jesus, and they've moved out beyond their wits. They're not thinking right. And so they begin to discuss together what they might do to Jesus. Mark says that they went outside the synagogue and they began discussing what they might do to Jesus with the Herodians. Now, you might just think, well, that's just another group of people, and it was just another group of people, but understand, the Pharisees hated the Herodians and vice versa. They didn't get along. But the principle of the enemy of my enemy is my friend is playing out here. The Pharisees didn't like Jesus. The Herodians didn't like Jesus. So they could team up together to destroy him. They wished to do Jesus harm. They are eager. They are hopeful that at least something can be done to stop his teaching, to stop his works. You know, there's still nearly 2 years left of public ministry for our Lord. The crucifixion is down the road, way down the road. And this is already occurring in these months of the first year of his public work. That's utter nonsense. But this is what a Pharisee does, because this is what a Pharisee is. Not Jesus. He's Lord of the Sabbath, and he wants to do good and to save life. As we think upon these 11 verses, there are two thoughts to conclude with. The first having to do with the Sabbath, and the second having to do with the Lord. Now, the Lord part's much more important, but I don't want to neglect the Sabbath part, because we obviously have many questions as followers of God in the New Testament age. The Sabbath was very strict, and there were directions for it in the Old Testament. So this is not the main point, but I do want to say this, that of the Ten Commandments, only 9 are repeated in the New Testament. All of them except rest on the Sabbath as a rule. Some Christians look at this as something to continue because it's a creation ordinance. And this is where I would place myself, that the law was given in Exodus, but this idea of a pattern of living out life every 7 days, it was given in Genesis chapter 2. So the law can be confined to Israel and what they were to do in their time of following after God. Jesus fulfilled all the law, and therefore we don't follow the law anymore as followers of God in the New Testament era. But we can look at this direction and say, well, this goes all the way back to kind of God's cadence for existence for mankind. And so while we want to look at that portion of it, Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16 is very clear. It says, do not let anybody be your judge regarding new moons, festivals, and Sabbaths, time of rest. So we don't create a whole list of rules on what we can do and what we can't do on a Sabbath day, a day of rest. That's between you and the Lord. What we do want to say is that there's wisdom in God's model, because God did it. And there's a purpose he did it. He did it as a way of instructing us. He knows how we function the best. And this is a good pattern. So I think as we look at this secondary teaching from this passage, we understand that there's work first and then rest. And as we take into account all of what we're taught through Scripture, we know that we're to be diligent in our work. And we also are to be intentional in our rest. Take time regularly to reflect upon what God has accomplished in the previous week for you. Know that our ultimate rest comes in our relationship with Christ, and we look forward to that Sabbath rest in eternity. But don't disregard this and throw it out. See God's pattern here and incorporate that into your own life. More importantly, here is our view of the Lord. Secondly, understand that he is Lord of the Sabbath. And this is more than just a title. This is more than just a role. We say it without thinking. Jesus is Lord. But what does that mean for you and your life? Live like Jesus is your master. He's Lord of the Sabbath. He's Lord of the earth. He is Lord of the entire Old Testament law. He is Lord of the harvest. He's Lord of everything. Most specifically, he is Lord of your life. And God calls us to live in a way that reveals it's true. He's Lord of your life. So Luke teaches us much in these first 11 verses of chapter 6. And we continue to see that Jesus has authority over everything, including the Sabbath. Let's pray.